Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, there's good news to be had all over the world. And today, we'll tell you where to find it with our guest, Will Doig, executive editor of Reasons to Be Cheerful. It's a nonprofit online magazine. At 12:30, we'll revisit a conversation we had about sauerkraut with food writer and sauerkraut superfan Julia Skinner. But first, you have a good news story to share? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Will Doig, thank you for joining in today. Appreciate it very much.
Great to be here.
So in 2019, Reasons to Be Cheerful was started by you and an internationally known musician and former Talking Heads frontman.
Yes, David Byrne. He started this online magazine a little more than 5 years ago. After starting it, even before that, as a personal project where he was really just trying to find some good news out there when most of what he saw in the news wasn't that good. So what he did was he started collecting little bits of positive news and news of solutions that he found out in the world, saving it on his hard drive. And then at a certain point, he thought, maybe I'd like to share this with people. And so he hired me and some other folks to turn it into an online magazine. And that's just what we did. And that's what you'll find today.
It's a very cool idea and really fun to read. I'll tell you that. What are the required elements of a story to be published by Reasons to Be Cheerful?
So what we don't want to do is just kind of publish happy news, right? Like, yeah, we're not just looking for things that might make you feel good or maybe like nice ideas, but things that don't actually work. Our real requirement from every story is that it has to be about a solution that has been implemented and has shown evidence of success, so that everything you find on the website, you can know is actually out there working and making a positive impact on the world. And by doing that, then we can ensure that we're bringing the same sort of standards and rigors of conventional journalism to what we call solutions journalism, so that people take it seriously.
Yeah, it's a great idea, a great concept. And you're an independent, you're a nonprofit outlet. How do you pay the bills?
We have a few different ways that we get funding. We get some funding from foundations. We also have a membership program from people who are just readers, and they contribute every month voluntarily. Even though we don't have any paywalls or anything like that, we have about 3,000 members that give us money every month. And then we also do live events in various cities around the country where we'll come to your city and we'll talk about a solution that's happening where you live. And then we, you know, make some money from that too.
Well, it's cool. Didn't you help launch the popular website, The Daily Beast?
Yes, I did. That feels like ancient history, but yeah, that was in 2008, and that was a very different type of news than what I'm doing now.
Yeah, it is indeed. But what is it that intrigues you about getting publications going?
Oh, well, I do find that if you're, you know, in there from day one and you're creating something from the ground up, then it's just a really exciting way to, I don't know, put something new out into the world that might make a difference. I have to say, I feel like with this one, I've been doing this for over 20 years, and I feel like Reasons to Be Cheerful, I really feel like I'm contributing something to the world in a way that I've never quite felt before. Because to me, and I think to a lot of other people, this is what the news is often missing, right? We always hear about problems. We hear about what's going wrong, but we don't hear about what can be done to solve those problems. And that's the missing step in our minds, is like, what can we do to get involved and make the world a better place?
And Angela emailed and asked, solutions. Now, you've mentioned solutions. Her question is, to solutions to what problem or problems does your site focus on? And it's pretty broad range.
Yeah, as far as topic goes, we are really open to almost anything, right? We cover climate and environment stories. We cover public health. We cover education. As long as the solution has been put into practice and is working, then we're interested. Now, there's a few things we wouldn't cover, right? Like, we wouldn't cover a solution where you'd have to be a billionaire to make it work, or that, you know, yeah, it could only work in one particular place. It has to be something that people are doing either in their community or maybe an organization, and something that could be replicated elsewhere. Like, one of the things we find is that people will read our stories and then we'll get an email from them saying, hey, I read about a solution you talked about in Wisconsin, and now in my town in Ohio, we're doing that too. And that is our kind of our sort of gold standard, right? That's what we
want. Yeah, absolutely. And we've got some great examples to talk about from the magazine. And the first one is close to home here in Wisconsin. In late February, you published a story with the headline, No Spare Parts, How Great Lakes Fisheries Are Creatively Minimizing Waste. And the, you know, the story about a fishing industry in Iceland inspired what is now going on in the Great Lakes.
Yeah, this is not something I had ever really thought about myself, but, you know, a lot of the fish that get caught for seafood, most of that fish doesn't end up getting used, or it gets turned into fertilizer or something like that, because that's a way that fisheries can dispose of it without having to pay a lot of money. And then somebody went over to Iceland to see what they do. And Iceland a few years ago put some pretty strict limits on the amount of fish that their fisheries can catch. And so what the fisheries did in response to that was they said, we need to use more of the fish that we are catching. And so they started using the whole fish, every part of the fish they would find a different use for. And that might be something like, you know, gelatin or collagen being extracted from them to be used in cosmetics or in health supplements. Or it could be fish leather that they actually use to make clothes from. Either way, they found all these different uses for the fish. And so somebody from the Great Lakes region was over there talking to them and thought, we should be doing this too. And they have now gotten 90% of the commercial fishing companies in the Great Lakes region to sign this pledge to use 100% of the fish that they catch by the end of this year.
That it's absolutely amazing to me. And those products, you know, I had not thought about, and I guess I probably should have known this, but the skin.
Like, who thinks? Yeah, I mean, you don't think about that as being usable, but I guess that it is. And, you know, often sometimes it's not that we can't do these things, right? It's that we're not incentivized to, or that nobody has thought to do them. And all you need is a spark of inspiration from another place doing it. And then you think, oh, we could do that too.
And I guess skin is, and I, you know, I was reading this, the whole story was really interesting to me because, you know, it's actually something that's been, you know, it wasn't just invented a year ago. I mean, this is something that was traditionally back in Native times done.
Yeah, I think a lot of these solutions have been around for a long time. We actually have a special series that we're running right now that is about very old solutions that we could use for modern problems. And a lot of the time, the things that we are struggling with, these are problems that have been dealt with for centuries, and the people have found interesting solutions to. All we have to do is dig them up and publish them.
Yeah, and the environmental benefits on this side of reducing the fish waste is large. I mean, I saw the photo, the Iceland photo, I think it was, where, I mean, there's this whole array of products that can be made from the what was thrown away. And the Iceland guy said, you know, we also wanted something to do to honor the fish.
Yeah, that's right. I think that there's a growing awareness among a lot of people that, you know, with the way that we treat the environment, not only is it not working for us, but it's just not the right way to, you know, live in the world. And so I think part of this solution was really about honoring the fish, and the people who work in this industry, they're the closest to it. And I can see how they would really feel connected to it in a way that they wanted to honor.
Yeah. So that is a great story. And we just touched on the basics of it. You can still read that story online at the magazine, so Reasons to Be Cheerful. And I guess if you go to the, what's the best way? Just type in Reasons to Be Cheerful?
You could just Google us. You could type in reasonstobecheerful.world, which is our URL. And once you're there, you can sign up for our newsletter, which comes out once a week and compiles all the stories that we publish that week. And if you really like us, then you could even become a paying member and support us.
You know, and I haven't signed up yet, but I'm going to sign up right after the show. I really enjoyed, and frankly, it would give me some more ideas because we like to do shows like that on this 11 to 1 o'clock time slot. So I might be stealing some of your ideas after I read about them. I hope
that
you don't mind.
Hey, have us back. No, we'll come back and discuss them with you.
Well, there another story you had was paying drug users to stay sober, and that really works apparently.
Yeah. So this is one that you might, you know, not be surprised to learn. It was a little controversial. People hear this and they think, well, I don't want to just pay people to do what they should be doing anyway. I think that a lot of the time with, you know, addiction or substance use, we can, a lot of moralizing gets mixed in to the conversation. And instead, you know, we're never really interested in the ideology behind things. What we're interested in is what works. And so the reason we were attracted to this story is the incredible success that California has had with this. You know, we think of the opioid crisis as being like, well, that's often what makes the news. But in California, stimulants, as far as the number of deaths that they cause, are the biggest problem in the drug crisis. Deaths from stimulants more than quadrupled in California.
And that's things like stimulants would be like cocaine.
Like methamphetamine, cocaine, exactly. And so between 2011 and 2019, deaths from those drugs quadrupled. And so the state said, we have to do something. And so they started to pay people a small amount of money when they were in treatment for staying off drugs. And this wasn't just, you know, a way of saying, hey, here's some free cash, why don't you not use drugs? This was a way of stimulating the same reward center in the brain that is stimulated by drug use. And so there was real science behind it to say, this will work because this is something that is going to touch on the same sort of, you know, brain function that drug abuse does. And it really, really worked. They very carefully implemented it. It sort of increases incrementally the longer that the drug user is in the program, and they had incredible success with it. They have had overdose deaths in the state have fallen by 10% since they implemented the program. It's not probably all entirely due to that program, but it is seen as one of the key factors. And so, you know, from us, what we take from this is, listen, whether you agree with it or not, it's hard to argue with the numbers. This seems to be working. And in fact, it's cheaper than a lot of other ways of treating drug use as a public health problem, because you're really only giving people very small amounts of money in the end.
And they have to come in, what is it, weekly? Or I forget exactly the amount of time, but...
Yep. So it's a 24-week program. And they come in, and after each negative drug test, they receive a small amount of money. So for the first negative test, they get a gift card that's for $10. Second negative test, they get $11.50. It all goes up only as high as $26 in total. And it never goes above, as a grand total for the entire program, it never goes above $600. And so it's really, when you think about it, it's a very small amount of money to make a pretty big dent in a problem. That, again, is a cheaper way of dealing with it than a lot of traditional programs are.
Yeah, if you run the costs of group sessions, for example, with an expert, that that adds up pretty quickly, that cost.
Exactly, yeah.
So it's an amazing story. And do you think that's going to expand elsewhere? I mean, the fact that it is based on science and they can show success.
Yeah, I mean, one would hope, you know, obviously politics and ideology sometimes gets in the way of working solutions. What we really hope to do is to show that these solutions work, and almost as a way of kind of, you know, forcing places to justify not doing it, right? If you can go to somebody and say, why won't you do this? and you can show the numbers show that it works, then it becomes harder for places to say, well, you know what, we don't agree with that, or we don't think that's a good idea. What we're trying to do is stick with the data and stick with the evidence and say, well, whether you agree with it or not, it works. And so that puts pressure on states, governments, organizations to implement solutions that work rather than worrying about the politics of it.
Another story I wanted to mention, I was really intrigued by this, it was about how a Colombian city cooled dramatically in just 3 years. And this is one about the creation of green corridors in a Colombian city.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would imagine many of your listeners live in places that might be getting warmer. And in cities, especially, it's a big problem, right? Because in cities, we have the heat island effect. A lot of heat gets trapped in all that concrete and on all the cars. And so, you know, cities are looking for ways to cool down. And Medellin in Colombia is a city that has always been known for its temperate climate. It's known as the city of eternal spring because it's just beautiful all year round. But even Medellin was starting to get hotter. And so the city was looking for something that they could do about this. And so starting in 2016, they started creating what they call green corridors. These are basically places where they have planted a lot of trees and plants and different types of foliage in corridors around the city. And they just kept doing it year after year, starting in 2016. And now, by 2021, they had added 2.5 million plants and 880,000 trees. And each of these had kind of been carefully curated to maximize their impact in terms of cooling the city, choosing the right plants, putting them in the right places. And now the temperature of the city has fallen by 2 degrees Celsius, which might not sound like a lot, but ecologically speaking, that's a big drop and it makes a big difference in the ecology of a city. And officials expect the temperature of the city to fall a further 4 to 5 degrees over the next few decades because of this, even taking into account climate change, which you would think would be getting warmer. Instead, they expect the city to get cooler. So this is exactly the type of solution that you would hope other cities that are having heat problems could choose to implement.
It's amazing. And I think it just leads to a better life. These green corridors, they've got to be places where people can work their way through the city, or they can, you know, have a green spot or a green space to look at and maybe recreate in a little bit.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if people want to go to our website, reasonstobecheerful.world, you can go to the story and see the photos. And honestly, this is one of those practical solutions where you just think, this is a beautiful solution too. I would love to live in a place like this.
Yeah. And one of the photos was of one of their, like, almost like a skyscraper, but covered with plants.
Yeah. Yeah. They've actually covered the entire sides of certain buildings with plants. It's a gorgeous look, and it just happens to be something that's really good for the city too.
Yeah, it is very, very cool. And are other cities in Colombia?
You know, I don't know if anyone else. I don't know if anyone else in Colombia is doing this. I think it's the type of solution that probably takes a real commitment from the city to do. So I'm not sure that it's spread elsewhere. I would suspect that it's being done on a smaller scale in other cities, because Medellin is quite a big city, and they might be the sort of the test case to see if this can be done on a really large urban scale.
Another story you brought to our attention describes a couple in England who started a wild hedgehog rescue and rehab center, and they named the center Prickles in a Pickle. Tell us about Judy and Alan Oliphant.
So this story is about hedgehog highways, which is a real thing that exists in England. Hedgehogs are a really, you know, like a very prominent species in England and in cities in England. They're everywhere. But Britain has lost about a third of hedgehogs since 2000. Due to fragmentation or habitat loss. And part of the reason for this is because a lot of hedgehogs live in urban areas, and their habitat is essentially the little gardens that are behind buildings and houses in these urban areas. And people put up fences between their gardens, and so there's no way for the hedgehogs to sort of migrate from yard to yard. which they need to do to survive. And so some people have come up with the idea of putting in what they call hedgehog highways, which are essentially little paths and little holes and fences that they have cleared to make sure that hedgehogs in the city can go from one yard to the next. And it has been not only cute, but incredibly successful. So they found in a 2001 study that more than 120,000 of these highways are now connecting 240,000 gardens across the UK, allowing hedgehogs to move from place to place. And they have found that after this long historic decline in urban hedgehogs, it is now starting to level off. And there have even been very early signs of improvement in the hedgehog population. So this was like a clear, very clear success story to us. It's also really appealing to readers. It's our most popular story that we've published so far this year. And it's just an incredible solution and one that I feel like almost anybody could get behind.
And they're insect eaters, right? Hedgehogs are insect eaters, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think they are. So that's another reason to want them around in your yard, I suppose.
And they're not eating up all your vegetables. And there in England, I think according to the story, in England, the hedgehog, if it's not, probably the most popular animal, or at least certainly in the top couple three animals liked by people in England.
Yes. And this is another story where if you want to come to our website and see the pictures, I think that you'll find it's delightful. Even the hedgehog highways, the little holes in the fences, they even people will put up like a little tiny plaque above the hole that says hedgehog highway, which is to ensure that nobody blocks that hole so that the hedgehogs can continue to come through.
And there's even little hedgehog houses and.
Yeah. I mean, there's an entire, like, almost miniature society of hedgehogs going on in these gardens.
I love that story. You must get a lot of, it must be fun to have a job in something, in a magazine like this.
I mean, I have to say it's great. You know, to get to think about ways that the world is getting better rather than worse is a real gift as a journalist. And I think it's pretty rare in journalism. But yeah, it's, you know, the fact that we are reporting not just on news that makes you feel good, but news that is actually making a positive impact on the world. It's a great combination. And I honestly think that solutions journalism is starting to catch on more. I've noticed more mainstream news organizations starting to incorporate it into what they do. And part of that is because people are starting to tune out the news a little bit. There was a study by the Reuters Institute a couple of years ago where they asked people, are you paying attention to the news? And 36% of people said, no, I'm not paying attention anymore because it's too negative. But about half of those news avoiders said, I am interested in news that offers solutions. And so I think that solutions journalism is starting to catch on and that there's more demand for it.
I agree with you, Will. And thank you so much for being with us. Will Doig is executive editor of Reasons to Be Cheerful. It's a nonprofit online magazine. As I said, I'm going to sign up for it as soon as the show's over. Will, thank you again. Reasons to Be Cheerful, the name of the magazine. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.